Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 351, titled Mind Jihad, Part 3, More About the Muslim Brotherhood. This is being recorded on March 9th of the year 2002. This broadcast is going to continue discussion and analysis of the events in and around the attacks of September 11th, 2001. Now, very quickly, this program is going to be continuing our discussion of Islamofascism. This should not be misunderstood as characterizing Islam as fascist, but rather there is a very profound element within Islam that constitutes a form of theocratic fascism, and it in turn has very strong relationships with not only international fascism through the ages, but also elements of the petroleum industry, elements of the intelligence or the petroleum faction of U.S. intelligence, and through that and beyond that, the underground Reich. I have analyzed the September 11th, 2001 attacks as literally constituting a synthesis of the attack on Pearl Harbor and the Reichstag fire. If Hitler had been in the White House when Pearl Harbor was attacked, this is basically what you would be seeing. It is both an attack by a hostile foreign power, and it constitutes what may very well turn out to be the coming of fascism to America. We're going to begin by taking a look at someone who is very familiar to longtime listeners. This is Jörg Haider, the so-called yuppie fascist of Austria, whose Freedom Party began in the late 40s as a vehicle for the rehabilitation of Austrian Nazis who had served Hitler. In many ways, his party constitutes sort of a three-piece suit reconstitution of fascism, albeit with a superficially friendly face. We've dealt with Jörg Haider in the past. We've also dealt with Saddam Hussein and the fascist antecedents of his regime in Iraq, and also in connection with the Bormann Organization and the remarkable work of Paul Manning, we've dealt with the fact that Muammar Gaddafi's Secret Service was put together by former Gestapo chief Heinrich Mueller, who in turn was running a group of ex-SS officers through the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit that was recruited first to put together Nasser's Secret Service and then later Gaddafi's. In the context of Jörg Haider, in the context of his fascist heritage and fascist manifestations, and in the context of the fascist heritage of Saddam Hussein and also of the Secret Service of Muammar Gaddafi, consider the following. And again, if my talk of Islamofascism seems crazy, well, listen to the following. This is from the Financial Times of Tuesday, March 5th of 2002. In the Avenue of the Americas column on the op-ed page, we find the following item titled Life Change, and it reads, Is Jörg Haider, Austria's extreme right-winger, about to become a Muslim? Saif el-Islam Gaddafi, son of the Libyan president, says his controversial friend Haider has asked him for a German-language Quran and told him he wants to become a Muslim. According to Gaddafi, Haider's ancestors originated in Arab Andalusia 400 years ago and converted to Christianity, which may explain just why Haider ignored the anger of Washington and Vienna recently to travel to Iraq. And I would point out that that came after there was a pointed diplomatic, at least saber-rattling, in the direction of Iraq by the United States. Jörg Haider then begins giving open diplomatic support to Saddam Hussein. And that exemplifies what I have called the Islamo-fascist slash underground Reich axis. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood, a fellow named Youssef Nada, who is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, also headed up a financial organization called Al-Taqwa, later renamed Nada Management and now closed. Nada Management and Al-Taqwa were alleged by the United States and other intelligence services to have been involved with Osama bin Laden's organization, something that Youssef Nada and Al-Taqwa deny. We're going to be taking a look at some of the heritage of the Muslim Brotherhood, and we're also going to take a look in particular at some of the Muslim Brotherhood's connections to various Islamic charitable organizations, which in turn have been alleged to have served as fronts for terrorist activity. This, like so many aspects of the 2001 attacks of September 11th, should not be oversimplified. Many of these institutions no doubt do serve as charitable institutions, but religious and charitable institutions have also traditionally been utilized by intelligence services for covert operations. So this is not a situation to be oversimplified, just as the issue of denying people their civil rights in this country who may be connected to terrorism is not to be oversimplified. it's a very bad precedent, but when legitimate organizations and religious organizations are used for intelligence purposes, it leads to that sort of abuse. We're going to turn now to the book Dollars for Terror, subtitled The United States and Islam. That was authored by Richard LaBeviere, translated by Martin Demare, published in softcover by Algora Publishing in New York. It was copyright 2000 in softcover. The ISBN number is 1-892941-06-6. Their website, www.algora.com. And we're going to review briefly some of the fascist heritage of the Muslim Brotherhood, which in turn we're going to discuss in connection with the September 11th attacks. First, we're going to take a look at Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, and not only some of the political allegiance between the Muslim Brotherhood and the fascist powers of Europe, but also how the Muslim Brotherhood was structured along Islamo-fascist lines, and this will perhaps clarify that term. Turning to Dollars for Terror, lastly, the emergence and the rise to power of fascism, hostile to French and British colonialism, gave rise to many analogies with corporatist propaganda and the methods of mobilization of Mussolini's gangs. Denouncing philosophy and the social sciences as practices contrary to the teachings of the Quran, Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, founded the essentials of his message on the condemnation of the principle of separation of the state and religion, and set the establishment of a theocratic state as his movement's goal. He also preached the reestablishment of the caliphate as the only framework that could be effective in uniting all the believers, and promoted the dissolution of political parties which, according to him, divide the Muslims. Reducing Western civilization to colonialism, Hassan al-Banna summarizes his movement's ideology thus, quote, "Islam is doctrine, divine worship, the fatherland, the nation, religion, spirituality, the Quran, and the sword," unquote. And then of some of the ideological structures of this movement, skipping down, and by the way, we went into this in more detail in For the Record 343. Taking Italy's choices under Mussolini for inspiration, the economic program of the Brotherhood set three priorities: the instigation of a land reform, the prohibition of usury, and the termination of income tax, which was replaced by the religious tax, the zakat. The social policy foresaw a new law on labor founded on corporations. This economic program would more directly reveal its relationship to totalitarian ideologies a few years later with the works of Muhammad Ghazali, Islam and Economic Questions, of Syed Qutb, Social Justice in Islam, and of Al-Bahi Lotfi, Islam, Neither Communism Nor Capitalism. The populist content of such writings corresponds to the social profile of most of the followers, who were recruited from the better-off rural populace and the urban middle class. The brothers denounced the profiteers and those who were starving the people. Muhammad Ghazali recommended, quote, "an economic regimen similar to that which existed in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy," unquote. The moral code is also an important component in this program, which is intended to create the, quote, "new Muslim man," unquote. It is founded on the strict observance of the rules of Islam, the punishment of any transgression, and on a teaching strictly in conformity to the precepts of Islam. Women's role in society is examined closely. The notion of the equality of the sexes is inherently negated by the concept of the supremacy of male social responsibilities. Justified by a literal interpretation of the Quran, the, quote, "natural," unquote, place of the woman is in the home. That's some of the fascist heritage and ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood, reviewing again very briefly an alleged allegiance of Youssef Nada of Al-Taqwa, later Nada Management, alleged again by the United States to be associated with Al-Qaeda. Its Nassau, Bahamas branch was founded in part with capital from six members of the bin Laden family. Turning again to Dollars for Terror of Youssef Nada, we read, But Yosef Nada is even better known to the Egyptian secret services, who have evidence of his membership in the armed branch of the fraternity of the Muslim Brotherhood in the 1940s. At that time, according to the same sources, he was working for the Abwehr under Admiral Canaris and took part in a plot against King Farouk. This was not the first time that the path of the Muslim Brothers crossed that of the servants of the Third Reich. The founder of the fraternity himself, Hassan al-Banna, served as an intermediary between those who went on to become the free officers, in particular Anwar al-Sadat, and the agents of Nazi Germany. By the way, Admiral Canaris was the head of the Abwehr German military intelligence in World War II. Now, we're going to take a look at some more connections and operational branches of al-Taqwa, later Nada Management. And by the way, we've talked about that in, for the record, 335, 336, 338, 340, 341, 2, 3, 4, and 350, among other programs. Now, turning to some of the Italian connections of al-Taqwa, now bear in mind Yosef Nada and his heritage and the allegation that he is connected to al-Qaeda, which he and associates firmly deny. This is, and that, by the way, alleged by the U.S. and other governments, this is one of the Italian connections of al-Taqwa. And turning to Dollars for Terror, we read, "The Milanese connection originates in the Bahamas. Since leaving its first head office in Nassau, al-Taqwa established itself at NIGH, Nasreddin International Group Holdings, 10 Dewall Street in Nassau." And again, six members of the bin Laden family helped to capitalize this branch. Continuing, "The NIGH holding company deserves close attention. Yosef Nada's assistant, Ali Galeb Himat, works there. The Bank of Gotard is NIGH's bank through account CCB number 313656 through the agency of Chiasso in the name of a charity foundation. The Bank of Gotard also appears in a confidential report on al-Taqwa's activity under the heading of Business Connections. The bank manager of Gotard, Claudio Generali, told me that he does not know either al-Taqwa or its director, much less the holding company NIGH. The president and creator of NIGH, Nasreddin Ahmed Idris, who also appears on the list of the shareholders in al-Taqwa, is honorary consul of Kuwait in Milan. Living in Italy, Switzerland, and Morocco, this businessman directs a multitude of financial companies, most of which end up leading again to the nebula of al-Taqwa." We're going to take a look at an al-Taqwa subsidiary in Italy called Gulf Office, and in turn, we're going to look at evidentiary tributaries running between this subsidiary and Italian Prime Minister and former P2 member Silvio Berlusconi, and we're going to review another element connecting the milieu of Berlusconi with the milieu of Yosef Nada from FTR 342. Reading again from Dollars for Terror, speaking of one of the subsidiaries of al-Taqwa, one of them, Gulf Office, Association for Commercial, Industrial, and Tourist Development between the Gulf States and Switzerland, currently dormant, had been housed in the same building as the Mosque of Lugano. In 1994, the Italian judicial system had its sights on Gulf Office and conducted an inquiry into its activities in the context of the Operation Clean Hands. Well, Operation Clean Hands will be well known to veteran listeners to this program. That was a not altogether successful inquiry on the part of the Italian judicial and political authorities into the web of political corruption in Italy, which embraced not only the heirs to Mussolini, but also organized crime, elements of Western intelligence, including NATO intelligence, and also the P2 lodge of Licio Gelli, one of whose members was Silvio Berlusconi. Licio Gelli was an Italian fascist and, in many ways, the crypto-fascist, de facto crypto-fascist leader of Italy in much of the post-war period. Nicknamed the Puppet Master, he was, among other things, an honored guest at Ronald Reagan's inauguration. And a member of the P2, the late Philip Guarino, was on the Republican Ethnic Heritage Organization, the overtly fascist wing of the Republican Party that we've spoken about many times in the past, most recently in, for the record, 346. Turning now to a discussion of Prime Minister Berlusconi and clean hands, and bear in mind that the subsidiary of Altaqua called Gulf Office was a focal point of the Clean Hands Inquiry in 1994. In that context, consider the following article from The Guardian, that's the British Guardian, of January 25th of 2002. This is an article by Philip Willan, W-I-L-L-A-N, in Rome, and its headline, UN tells Berlusconi, leave courts alone. This is accessed from their website at www.guardian.co.uk. The full URL will appear in the written description in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website when the description for FTR 351 is posted. Again, The Guardian 125, 2002, by Philip Willan in Rome. UN tells Berlusconi, leave the courts alone. The UN Human Rights Commission has stepped into the Italian row about the independence of the judiciary, responding to the recent protest by magistrates against political interference in a planned reorganization. Its special rapporteur on the independence of judges and lawyers, Dato Param Kumaraswamy, has asked to visit Rome urgently to investigate. His letter pointed out that members of the judiciary had accused the government of trying to delay proceedings against the Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, who was facing charges of bribery. Those charges, by the way, were brought under the investigation known as Clean Hands, which was also looking into the Altaqua subsidiary, Gulf Office. Skipping down. Mr. Kumaraswamy said in a statement that he had asked to visit after claims by Francesco Saverio Borelli, Milan's most senior judge, about interference in trials and reports of legal action pending against the judge. Mr. Borelli, who led the Clean Hands Corruption Inquiry in the 1990s, accused Rome of demonizing the judiciary and introducing dangerous reforms, including the removal of escorts from prosecutors and judges. That, by the way, is police escorts. Continuing. The judges say that plans to reorganize the judiciary could put prosecutors under government control. Mr. Kumaraswamy said, confrontation of this nature could undermine the rule of law in Italy, unquote. Skipping down. The timing brought to mind the 1994 incident when the Prime Minister was formally notified that he was under investigation for alleged bribery as he chaired a UN crime conference in Naples. Mr. Berlusconi has been accused of rushing through legislation intended to protect himself against the judiciary by putting obstacles in the way of international cooperation between magistrates and reducing the penalties for false accounting. He denies charges of bribery, tax evasion, and false accounting, and says he is the victim of political bias. One should note in particular, in addition to the legislation, the fact that police escorts are going to be removed according to under the Berlusconi program from judges and prosecutors. As we looked at in For the Record programs, or RFA rather, 17 through 21, there was a history of political assassinations of Italian judicial personnel who have been investigating P2 corruption. Berlusconi, a member of the P2. Now, bearing in mind the fact that Altaqua subsidiary Gulf Office was investigated in connection with Clean Hands, consider the following, reviewing an item from For the Record 342. This was researched and translated for us by Dave White. This comes from L'Espresso of November 22nd of 2001. It's by Peter Gomez and Leo Sisti. It's headlined, The Alms of Monsieur Youssef Nada. And it reads in part as follows. October 19th, 1997. A Saudi Boeing carrying Crown Prince Al-Walid lands at Miramar Airport in Rimini. A white Rolls-Royce whisks the Saudi prince to a meeting organized by the Piu Manzu Center. In the middle of a small crowd ready to pay his respects to the house of Al-Walid stands a businessman already familiar to the prince, Youssef Nada. The Italian-Tunisian businessman is one of the founders of Altaqua Limited. The prince and the businessman set out for the Novelli Theater, the site of the conference. From the stage, the prince begins his address with the words, I have confidence in Italy, unquote. 4 years later, August 2001. This, by the way, a month before the attacks. Prince Al-Walid, the Saudi associate of Mediaset, is received by Silvio Berlusconi. 2 months later, the prince gives a $10 million check to New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. Meanwhile, the name of Youssef Nader appears on George Bush's list of alleged financiers of the terrorist Osama bin Laden. Mediaset is the largest of Silvio Berlusconi's many formidable media holdings, and 48% of Mediaset is owned by Prince Al-Waleed, part of the Saudi elite, who have been rather conclusively at this point linked to the funding of Al-Qaeda, and who have also funded Al-Taqwa. Whether or not the charges that Al-Taqwa is connected with Al-Qaeda wind up being borne out in court. I say in court because there's often a difference between intelligence matters and judicial matters. Now, turning again to discussion of Al-Taqwa in Italy, turning again to the book Dollars for Terror, in a chart of the Financial Brigade of Milan, the telephone coordinates of the Gulf office are the same as those on a propaganda video for the Algerian Armed Islamic Groups, or GIA, that have been sold under the table in the mosques of Europe since the end of 1994. The images were recorded after the attack on the prefect of Tisimsilt and its guard some 80 miles south of Algiers. It was one of the first large-scale ambushes by the GIA in January of 1994. The document does not deal with the attack itself, but to the return of the Islamists to their camp. It shows their joy at having brought death to irreligious people to have caused death in the name of Allah. Lingering on the weapons seized during the ambush, the camera closes in on the commando's chief, who harangues his flocks, quote, "These weapons, which are here before you, we seized them from the impious, thanks to God. When our brothers in the true faith see this film, they will see that God is with them and that God will help them, as he helped us, to overcome their enemies. Praise God." In fact, Gulf office served as a financial and material cover for the Islamic communities of Tessin and Milan, where a certain Sa'ad officiates. He has free access to all the company's facilities to provide support for various Islamist groups of the Maghreb. Through his relationships with the representatives, unquote, of the Algerian Islamic Salvation Front, or FIS, and its antennae in the Lyon region, Sa'ad saw to the importation of the video cassettes produced by an agency in Kuwait City. What we're going to do next is to take a break from the book Dollars for Terror, and bearing in mind Gulf office and some of the Italian connections of Al-Taqwa, and in also the connections of Gulf office to the Clean Hands Inquiry, which in turn was looking into Silvio Berlusconi and charged him with bribery. Berlusconi himself has overlap with the milieu of the Saudi elite and also Al-Qaeda. We're going to take a look now at an article from the Wall Street Journal this past week, which would indicate that perhaps the profound petrodollar connection is in fact being tweaked, so to speak, by the Saudi elite, and that the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, Paul O'Neill, may perhaps be undergoing a little bit of revision in connection with the attitude that he has taken towards some of the Islamic charities, which appear to be doubling, not that they aren't charities, but are doubling as Al-Qaeda funding conduits, according to the research of numerous intelligence services, and not just the United States. Wall Street Journal, Thursday, March 7th of 2002, has the following article by James M. Dorsey. This is special to the Wall Street Journal, Dateline Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. It's headlined, "O'Neill Promises Caution in Citing Saudis." U.S. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill told Saudi officials and business leaders here he understands their concern that freezing the assets of charities and individuals based in the kingdom could damage their reputations. The secretary sought to reassure the Saudis that the U.S. is refining its processing of intelligence to minimize such damage. Mr. O'Neill, on the third leg of a four-nation Mideast tour aimed at cementing Gulf state cooperation with the Bush administration's anti-terror campaign, also said he would consider a proposal that the U.S. issue a list of Islamic charities it considers free of terrorist links. The secretary took part in talks with Saudi officials, including Crown Prince Abdullah bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud, Interior Minister Prince Nayef bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud, and Finance Minister Ibrahim bin Abdul Aziz bin Abdullah Al Asaf, as well as a group of prominent Saudi businessmen. That would almost certainly, by the way, include the Bin Mahfouzes and the Bin Ladens. Both families have connections to the Bin Bushes. Continuing, Mr. O'Neill said that the U.S. is fine-tuning its targeting of institutions and individuals suspected of funding terrorists and speeding up the processing of those it has already acted against, according to the secretary and Saudi participants in the meetings. Quote, "There is a learning process going on here," unquote, Mr. O'Neill said later in a telephone interview, skipping down. The Saudis, who since the September 11th attacks have worried that the kingdom's businessmen were being singled out as suspects, said they walked away from their meeting with the secretary reassured. Quote, "I was very impressed," said Ghassan al-Suleiman, a member of the board of the Jeddah Chamber of Commerce, again quoting, "He is very knowledgeable and a very good listener. He showed a lot of understanding," unquote. Mr. O'Neill said he had embarked on his trip to, quote, "share ideas and insights and to have an opportunity to observe and learn," unquote. He said his meetings in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Bahrain left him, quote, "very impressed as well." Mr. O'Neill said his visit so far had lifted the veil of mystery from Islamic banking and that he had learned that, quote, "it is a legitimate way of doing business," unquote. There is no doubt that there is business legitimacy to these organizations, also that they serve as genuine charitable organizations, but there also would appear to be little doubt that they're also being utilized for terrorist purposes, which makes things rather complex. One thing that I did find interesting was the degree of deference that Mr. O'Neill had shown under the circumstances, just like his superiors, Crown Prince George Walker bin Talal Abdul Aziz and company. This, no doubt, and all humor under the circumstances aside, three powerful Saudi connections to the American economy, oil, in turn the petrodollar investment into American business, such as Carlyle, such as Arbusto Energy, which joins both George's Bush to the Bin Laden family, and also the Reagan debt of the 1980s, that much of U.S. foreign debt is now held by the Saudis. One wonders whether that perhaps has something to do with the learning process that Mr. O'Neill described. Now, in the conclusion of the second side of this, of this program, we took a look at Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill's recent visit to Saudi Arabia, and he appeared, shall we say, more understanding of the Saudi position than one might perhaps suppose in light of the irrefutable evidence of Saudi complicity in the September 11th attacks. We're not hearing a lot about that, but in addition to the fact that 15 of the 19 Saudis were hijacked, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, more than 100 of the 158 detainees down in Guantanamo are Saudi nationals, and in light of the fact that the Saudi chief of intelligence, who was allegedly running bin Laden, resigned the week before the attacks, the Saudis canceled their military maneuvers with the U.S. hours before they were scheduled to begin in August, and Crown Prince Abdullah told George Bush 10 days before the attacks that the U.S. stance vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was unacceptable. I think you've got a pretty clear case for Saudi involvement. In any event, what we're going to be looking at here is the charitable organization Relief International, known here as Mercy International. Note that that organization's name was originally in Arabic. It was translated and transliterated for the French language edition of Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeuvière, and then in turn Martin Demers translated the book into English. So Mercy International, Relief International are the same organizations. In For the Record 341, we took a look at the freezing of Mercy International's assets and also the seizure of assets in Bosnia as well. The American assets in Michigan. Note the relationship here. Note that Altaqua has, as one of its subsidiaries, Gulf Office, or had, Altaqua has been closed. And note here the relationship in turn between Gulf Office and Altaqua and Mercy International. It is alleged here in this book that Mercy International is an offshoot of Altaqua and the Muslim Brotherhood. Mercy International, or Relief International, headquartered in the United States. So this is an American branch of this Islamo-fascist organization. Turning once again to Dollars for Terror, subtitled The United States and Islam by Richard LaBaviere of Altaqua, Gulf Office, and Relief or Mercy International, we read. But Nasreddin Ahmed Idris's real representative at the head of Gulf Office is another member of the Muslim Brothers, Khaldun Diyadin, who belongs to the Syrian branch of the organization. He too was employed, unquote, by the bank Altaqua, which he represented in Lugano before he took on the coordination of the activities of Mercy International, unquote, an Islamic humanitarian organization. The humanitarian organizations, Islamic non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, represent one of the other derivative products, unquote, from Altaqua Bank. Mercy International, again parenthetically also Relief International, is a Swiss association founded on May 13, 1989. Its charter specifies that its goals encompass, quote, all humanitarian actions, especially in the cases of natural catastrophe and war, unquote. Mercy International became well known for its various charitable activities on behalf of the Bosnian Muslims, but it was also active in circumventing the embargo on weapons bound for the Bosnian army and in recruiting mercenaries and international volunteers, unquote, for that country. Mercy International diversified its activities toward Algeria, in particular in the field of repatriating the Arab Afghans to this country and providing them with funds and logistical assistance. The official personnel chart of Mercy International indicates that the association is chaired by Jassem Muhalal al-Yassin, a resident of Kuwait. Chief of the Kuwaiti Muslim Brothers, he oversees the management of the political branch, the Islamic Constitutional Movement, the social branch, the Association for Social Reform, and the branch for external action, Solidarity Committees. He collaborates closely with the Sudanese leader Hassan el-Turabi to coordinate support for the Islamist movements of the Maghreb. Lastly, the director, Majid al-Rifai, who is also a Kuwaiti, is a member of the Muslim Brothers and serves as president of the Organization of the Islamic Appeal, the Al-Dawa al-Islamia. Today, Mercy International has moved its headquarters to the United States. It declares a gross budget of $2 million. By the way, today would be in 1999 when the book was published, or sometime immediately prior to that. Please note that Mercy International is alleged here to be an offshoot of Altaqua and the Muslim Brotherhood. Continuing. Officially, its emergency humanitarian aid programs focus on delivering food, drugs, clothing, and shelter. In the Balkans, Mercy International is still active in Bosnia. Lately, its efforts have also been seen in Albania, where it has developed several hospitals and orphanages. In his offices in Tirana, one finds Khaldun Diyadin, who in addition manages one of the principal channels for weapons delivery for the Kosovo Liberation Army, with the financial and logistical support of the World Islamic League. By the way, in addition to the fact that the president of Bosnia, Ali Izetbegovic, has a heritage in the 13th Waffen-SS or Hanjar Division, I would note that many of the members of the Kosovo Liberation Army are the sons and grandsons of various pro-fascist Balkan Muslim fighting formations, including and especially the 21st Waffen-SS Division, the Skanderbeg Division. We're going to take a look at how Relief International, or Mercy International, as it's called here, came to be deployed to the United States. And I would emphasize once again that one should not oversimplify the events of September 11th or the various gradations and divisions within the political forces that can be seen at work in those events. It has been my contention that the Islamo-fascist elements that attacked the Pentagon and the World Trade Center are in fact not only part of the underground Reich, but in fact were doubling on the United States, basically rather like a Trojan horse. In this context, I emphatically recommend that listeners contact Spitfire, the tape duplication service and CD duplication service that distributes work that I've done. Get a hold of RFA 37 and Miscellaneous Archive Show M61. It'll give you some good background. Now, in connection with Mercy International, or Relief International, alleged here to be an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Taqwa, and also alleged by the U.S. government and others to be involved with Al-Qaeda, we're going to take a look at the circumstances surrounding its relocation to and headquartering in the United States. The shepherding organization in this context is described by La Baviera as the CIA. I think that could be intelligently refined as to mean the petroleum/Bush-related faction of the CIA. Not only U.S. intelligence, but the CIA have many different factions. A good guy faction, to coin a term, helped to publish the book The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Arons. This here is another faction. And again, I should note that utilizing Islamists in the Balkans and also perhaps in the former Soviet Union and elsewhere in connection with petroleum activities is one of the uses to which the Islamists were apparently put. They then functioned in effect as a Trojan horse and attacked, bit the hand that had been feeding them. Of Relief International or Mercy International, its relocation to the United States, we read in Dollars for Terror. This, by the way, is this particular text is in the immediate aftermath of the bombings in Africa in August of 1998. In Nairobi, the FBI was mainly working to sort out the tangled web of ties between the Sudanese Secret Service, the Osama bin Laden organization, and the Islamic NGOs. Going from one surprise to another, the investigators ended up focusing on two American connections. The first relates to the organization Mercy International Relief Agency, whose direct involvement in the financing of the Afghan networks we have mentioned on several occasions. Active in Bosnia, Chechnya, and Albania, this subsidiary of the Muslim Brothers was able to establish its headquarters in the United States, in the state of Michigan, with the assistance of the CIA. The agency provided significant logistical and financial support to this humanitarian organization, enabling it to act clandestinely in the various Balkan conflicts as well as within the Muslim communities of several Russian republics. On the basis of the FBI's conclusion, the Kenyan government announced the dissolution of Mercy International and five other Islamic NGOs that had probably also enjoyed Saudi and CIA support. Now, what we're going to look at next is some of the connections and the heritage, once again, of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, we took a look at the Muslim Brotherhood at considerable length and, among other programs, For the Record 343, Mind Jihad Part 2. We reviewed some of its fascist structure or Islamo-fascist structure and heritage in the first side of this program. Now, some names. Remember Hassan el-Banna, who founded the Muslim Brotherhood? We're going to take a look here at his son-in-law, named Saeed Ramadan. And later on in the broadcast, we're going to take a look at Saeed Ramadan's sons, or two of them, those named Hani and Tariq Ramadan, or Ramadan Hani, as it is also described here. So again, the heritage, Hassan al-Banna, founder of Muslim Brotherhood. His son-in-law, Saeed Ramadan, succeeded his father-in-law as the head of the organization, and in turn, two of Saeed Ramadan's sons, Hani and Tariq Ramadan, also played key parts in some of the subsequent activities of the Muslim Brotherhood. Reviewing an item that we discussed in For the Record 343, in which lent to the title to that particular program, turning to the deployment of the Muslim Brotherhood, or the fraternity, as it's described here, to Germany after it was suppressed by President Nasser of Egypt, who initially was part of the Free Officers Association that enjoyed the Brotherhood's support. And by the way, some of the complexities of this were discussed in For the Record 350. Turning once again to Dollars for Terror, we read, "This pivotal role in the redeployment of the fraternity, played abroad by Saeed Ramadan, was also emphasized by Rifat Said, a deputy of the Egyptian left. Quote, "Before he settled in Europe, he, Ramadan, made long sojourns to Saudi Arabia with King Faisal, and then in Pakistan, where he worked with lawyers on the Islamic right. But by the end of the 1950s, he opened a new door by selling the Saudis on the idea of dawah, i.e. the propagation of Islam, especially in Europe. Thus, he proposed to them initially to open a center in Munich." "Why Munich? Why Germany?" I asked Rifat Said. Quote, "Because there one finds old complicities that go back to the late 1930s when the Muslim Brothers collaborated with the agents of Nazi Germany. And furthermore, Turkish immigration to Germany had started to become an important phenomenon. By soaking up the savings of these Muslim workers, Yusef Nada, like Said Ramadan, took advantage of an extremely favorable context and used it as a springboard for the Muslim Brothers' economic activities. For these various reasons, the Munich Center quickly became very important," adds the Egyptian deputy. And after redeploying to Munich, as described here, for the reasons discussed here, Said Ramadan then relocated to Geneva, Switzerland. And his reasons for doing so here are worth noting. In a number of our past broadcasts, we've taken a look at a very important Swiss Nazi named François Genoux. This is a very profound individual. We looked at him in miscellaneous archive shows, a very important individual. We looked at him in miscellaneous archive shows M19 and M21. We've visited with Kevin Coogan, the author of the book Dreamer of the Day, and discussed François Genoux. We've also taken a look at Genoux in connection with a number of different evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of the milieu of September 11th. What we're going to look at now is Said Ramadan's relocation to Geneva, obliquely described here as being intended to take advantage not only of the treasure of the FLN, that is the Algerian Liberation Organization that resisted successfully the French colonization of Algeria. It gained Algerian independence from France. But the banker for the FLN was the aforementioned François Genoux, and it was to be allied with Genoux and the FLN that Said Ramadan relocated to Geneva. Turning once again to Dollars for Terror, we read of the Brotherhood and Said Ramadan's relocation to Geneva. "The Saudis advised him to make his home in Switzerland for both financial and political reasons. After the Second World War, the petrodollars from the Gulf benefited from the discretion and efficiency of the Swiss banking world. With the Algerian War, the FLN used the French-speaking part of Switzerland as a sounding board. At the time, the Maghreb Circus," unquote, "polarized the energy of the news services, the spies, and the racketeers of every type, especially since Geneva is also the hub for the financial resources of the Algerian underground. Let us mention only the incident of the treasure of the FLN, at the center of which the banker François Genoux may be found. Ramadan and the Muslim Brothers thought that they could play a part in the Algerian process, as they had done in Palestine in 1947. Said Ramadan thus left Munich to settle in the city of Calvin." Parenthetically, I would add that, of course, was Geneva. Now, before we return to the heirs to Said Ramadan, his sons Hani and Tariq Ramadan, we're once again going to review some of the information about François Genoux that we've looked at in the past. We're going to be turning once again to the remarkable and encyclopedic volume Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yaki and the Postwar Fascist International. This book was published in soft cover by Otano Media, copyright 1999. The book was edited by on-air personality Dave Mandel of sister station WFMU-FM, ISBN number 1-57027-039-2. You can visit Otano Media's website at www.otanomedia.org. We've spoken about François Genoux in connection with a number of our broadcasts about September 11th. For the record, 333, 340, 341, 343, and 344, among others, talk about François Genoux. We touched on Genoux again in the last broadcast, number 350. By the way, my use of Kevin Coogan's text here should not be misunderstood as constituting an endorsement on the part of Kevin Coogan for the working hypothesis that I'm presenting on the September 11th attacks. Turning once again to Dreamer of the Day about Genoux, we review. On May 30th, 1996, an obscure Swiss banker named François Genoux committed suicide in Geneva, Switzerland. From the brief mention of his death in the New York Times, one would not know that one of the most important figures in the history of 20th century terrorism had died. And how many men can say that they were friends with both Adolf Hitler and Carlos the Jackal, skipping down? Genoux, too, was in the thick of things, having established a friendship with SS General Karl Wolff, leader of the German team in Italy that negotiated Operation Sunrise with Alan Dulles. Shortly after the war, Genoux acquired the publishing rights to the works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. He also played a major, if murky, role in aiding fugitive Nazi war criminals. Another key player in the post-war Nazi underground resident in Switzerland was SD Colonel Eugen Dolman, General Wolff's chief lieutenant in the talks with Dulles. Besides Wolff, Dolman and Genoux had another friend in common, Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Genoux first met the Grand Mufti in Jerusalem in 1936 and again in Berlin during the war. Skipping down of the relationship between François Genoux and the Grand Mufti and Johann von Leers, Goebbels' propaganda ministry, who ran anti-Semitic propaganda for Goebbels, and in turn, the relationship between François Genoux and the Algerian FLN and Genoux's assumption of the role as banker for the FLN. Bear in mind, it was Genoux and the treasurer of the FLN and the anti-French FLN resistance that was the motive for Saeed Ramadan relocating to Geneva. In 1955, with the Grand Mufti's friend Johann von Leers helping to run Egypt's propaganda ministry and its all-important Institute for the Study of Zionism, unquote, Genoux began to see Egypt as a base for the anti-French FLN independence movement in Algeria. He worked in Tangier with an ex-SS officer named Hans Reichenberg to create the Arabo-Africa Import-Export Company, which supplied the FLN with weapons. Arabo-Africa was actually a cover enterprise established by Werner Naumann's network and included Genoux's friend Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, the former finance minister of Nazi Germany. In Damascus, General Otto Reimer, Ernst Wilhelm Springer, and an ex-SS captain and RSHA operative named Alois Brunner created another gun-running operation, the Orient Trading Company, or OTRACO, to ship arms to the FLN militants. By the way, Brunner was a key aide to Adolf Eichmann. Continuing. Genoux's importance within the FLN increased when he became the group's banker. In 1952, Ahmed Ben Bella, one of the founders of the Algerian Organisation Speciale, or Algerian Organisation Speciale, or OS Independence Movement, escaped from a French jail. After spending several months underground, he resurfaced in Cairo to be personally blessed by Nasser. In the spring of 1954, Ben Bella left Cairo and traveled to Geneva, where he and three of his OS comrades created the organizational basis for the FLN. In 1958, Genoux and a Syrian named Zuhir Mardam co-founded the Banque Commerciale Arabe in Geneva to manage the FLN's war chest. One of Genoux's closest collaborators, Mohamed Kider, was Secretary General of the FLN's Political Bureau. And that discusses the Genoux role at the head of the banking of the FLN. Skipping down once again. After Algeria won its independence, Genoux became head of the Banque Populaire Arabe in Algiers. And again, it was Genoux's role in Geneva as the banker for the FLN that led Saeed Ramadan to promote the relocation of Muslim Brothers and his own relocation to Geneva. Now, we're going to take a look at Saeed Ramadan's sons. There were two of them. Bear in mind that Saeed Ramadan was the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. We're going to take a look at two of Saeed Ramadan's sons. Returning to Dollars for Terror, and so with the financial support of King Faisal of Arabia, Saeed Ramadan established the fraternity's political outpost for Europe in Geneva. In 1961, he founded the Islamic Center in Eau Vive, currently directed by one of his sons, Hani. Skipping down. Hani is the fourth son of the late Saeed Ramadan and his wife, Wafa Hassan al-Banna, the daughter of the founder of the Fraternity of the Muslim Brothers. Born in 1959 in Geneva, Hani is Swiss by nationality. After studies in the humanities, which led to teaching positions in various private and public establishments, Hani was associated very early by his father with the propaganda activities of the center and the mosque of Eau Vive. Although he is a less fluent talker than his brother Tariq, and has fewer ties in the intellectual and university circles, he has gained prominence nevertheless as the theorist of the family through his many media appearances. His letter to the editor, commentaries, and other public statements defend and illustrate the, quote, right to be different, unquote, the debate between civilizations, unquote, and the uncompromising dialogue with the West, unquote. His various activities have led to many conferences at the Islamic Center of the Eau Vive, where in recent years many demonstrations and open-air prayer sessions have been held for various Islamist causes in front of the European seat of the United Nations. The advantage of our presence in Europe, Hani Ramadan says, again quoting, is that we can take advantage of the freedom of the democratic regimes, unquote. For example, on March 11, 1995, Ramadan spoke during a gathering that was officially organized by the Algerian FIS. The demonstration, in fact, brought together the European supporters of the Armed Islamic Groups, or GIA. That's the Algerian FIS. And the center directed by Ramadan, which has enough meeting space for some 20 people, is also used as a hub for the European representatives of various organizations that are under surveillance by several European police forces. Frequently invited to the Lyon area by friendly associations, unquote, Hani Ramadan was barred from entering French territory on February 1, 1995, by the Ministry for the Interior. In a memorandum dated March 1997, the administration indicated that, quote, Mr. Ramadan is not just a Swiss citizen teaching French in a public establishment in this country. As he himself indicates, the interested party is a director of the Islamic Center of Geneva. This organization is known by the specialized police services to be a meeting for the principal European Islamists and the point where the circuits of financing converge. Mr. Ramadan is the grandson of the founder of the Fraternity of the Muslim Brothers in Egypt. Like his brother Mr. Ramadan Tariq, Mr. Ramadan Hani is thus an important figure in the European Islamist movement and entertains close relations with the Union of Islamist Organizations of France, or UOIF. This association has participated in demonstrations in favor of wearing the Islamic headscarf, and its sympathies extend to the Palestinian movement, Hamas, unquote. And again, if one wants to avoid oversimplifying these events, the author here, Richard Labevier, hints at a division of opinion, so to speak, between the CIA and the Pentagon vis-a-vis the Muslim Brothers. The American intelligence agencies, particularly the CIA, whose familiarity with the brothers goes back many years, still supervises the Saudi sponsorship of the fraternity. This protection of the Muslim Brothers by the House of Al Saud is considered by the Pentagon's Arab experts to be, quote, the essential element of a structural evolution of political Islam, unquote, a confidential memo explains. The programs I've recorded over the years are available from a CD and tape duplication service called Spitfire, one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Email mail at spitfirelist, one word, .com. Visit their website at www.spitfirelist.com. By the time you hear this program, there will be a detailed annotated description of the program in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Be sure to follow the links in that description to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM, which have virtually the entire For the Record series available for download and or streaming on Real Audio. The first airing of each For the Record program takes place at 9 p.m. on Monday night on KKUP. Visit their website for instructions on how to listen at www.kkup.com. This concludes side two of For the Record program number 351, titled Mein Jihad, Part 3, More About the Muslim Brotherhood. This is being recorded on March 9th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.